Testes.
Somebody had to.
Welcome to another episode of the Beer Opinions Podcast. My name is Pat Berger from Kaiser Tiger and Patty Longs, and with me, as always, is Bruce White of the Chicagoland Beer Tours. Bruce, how you doing?
Doing well, man. Enjoying the end of summer here. Beautiful Chicago. And rocking and rolling. Recovering from our live podcast.
Yes. I might still be hungover from that. It was a good one. Well, we are here at on location at the Dovetail Brewery. This is Dovetail Part Deux. We fucked up the first one, so we are giving ourselves a second chance here to talk to Bill and Hagen of Dovetail Brewery. Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
Fantastic.
Excellent. I should mention Bill and Hagen are the owners and mad scientists, founders, whatever you want to call it, of Dovetail Brewery. And I appreciate you guys coming back on to give this another go. We had some recording issues, but Sean is behind the laptop today, so I think we're going to be good.
Yeah. Shout out to Sean. All right.
And if we aren't, no one will hear this. So
we're very happy to be back, and we always enjoy talking to you guys.
So. Yeah. Thank you so much. And we're actually, for the listeners, we're in the second floor. So we're actually with the barrels. The barrels are amongst us.
We are surrounded by barrels, and
it's a very cool scene.
We have a train track right out the window here. So if you hear a train coming by, that is just authentic Chicago.
Yeah.
That's for vibration of the barreled beer. We cited our spot exactly for that.
Yeah.
If you believe that.
I don't at all.
I like it, though. You could sell that. I think that, you know.
Well, let's start with a little background and history of you guys and what brought you together and created Dovetail. Who wants to go first?
I'll go. So this is Hagen. Dovetail.
Dovetails.
We got to throw that out there. So you know, what we do here is continental European style beers, traditional methods. Bill and I, we're both certified master brewers, and we actually met at, in the Siebel Dömens program, the World Brewing Academy.
In Munich?
We met in Munich. We were taking the course at different paces, and we happened to meet up over there. That's where our paths coincided. Pretty quickly figured out that we enjoyed doing a little hands-on research and our favorite breweries were the breweries of continental Europe that are still doing things in very traditional ways, so like the say the lager breweries of Franconia. Or the lambic breweries of the Senna Valley, the monastery breweries. We really love the beers that those breweries produce, and we discovered that the common denominator between all these breweries, even when they're brewing different styles, is that they're all using in one way or another very traditional methods like decoction mashing, turbid mashing, spontaneous fermentation in the case of the lambic breweries, or open fermentation, long lagering times, things like that. And
it makes a difference, right?
It makes a huge difference. And then also, I think we're the only other brewer that either one had ever met that thought a 12-hour brew day was a good idea.
or longer.
Right? Or longer. In the case of last Tuesday.
probably the strongest argument against decoction is the 12-hour brew day. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. But there is a little controversy around it because there's a lot of brewers that will tell you it doesn't do anything. And I do feel that it does. I mean, there's, you know, the beers, the breweries that do it, there's a characteristic, a complexity to their beers that you just don't see, you know, that's rare and unique.
We obviously agree. And and to any brewer that believes that, I would say travel.
Right.
Travel and drink in situ, you know, because there's nothing like the easiest example is like go to the basement of Pilsner Urquell, where they still the basement, the cellar, you know, the
let's
cage.
Go there right now.
Let's pretend.
I'm gonna lock myself in that cellar next time I'm there. I swear.
Yeah, I mean, you try that beer, and that, you know, they're still brewing it the way they brewed it 175 years ago.
They do. They're sticklers for brewing it the exact way it was brewed. Yep. And I mean, I, you know, we all know my affection for the beer, and it makes a difference, man. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
And for the few lay people out there, shout out to my dad. All right, can you describe a little bit about that process, the decoction? And am I saying that right? I
hope yep,
that right. Decoction.
You know,
decoction.
Yeah.
So decoction in its simplest form, you know, so you start with the mash. Your combination of crushed grain and water. And inside those grains are enzymes that convert starches to sugars, right? And so the decoction methodology is using a boiling portion of that mash to add back into the main mash to raise it to different temperatures to allow those different enzymes to do their job. So for us at Dovetail, we remove a third of the mash, bring it to normal, which is all the starch has been converted, then boil it, and then add it back in and raise it to the next rest is what we call them. So like most of our products are a double decoction. Yesterday we brought back the Pilsner, which is a triple decoction. So we'll have that in a couple weeks. Well,
we're putting the dick back in decoction.
It's actually the cock.
It's a cock for short.
Yeah, and you know, some of our, I think actually one of our beers doesn't have a cock in it at all. The white.
The white is a step mash.
Yeah. It's weird. It's a weird day.
Yeah.
Short.
No, thank you. Thank you for detailing that out. I think that's helpful. Yeah. And
But you know, so here's what's nice about it is when you do a decoction, in the case of our process, we have a direct fire kettle, which means we've got a firebox underneath our kettle and we blow a huge gas flame into there. And you end up caramelizing a portion of that boiled mash, and that caramelization adds a depth of character. It adds like our own thumbprint to it. And there are, you know, the easiest thing to say about decoction mashing, against decoction mashing is that, you know, malts are so well modified these days that you don't need to do it. And you can use melanoidin malt to simulate the decoction process. Like, I'm so fucking tired of
hearing that. Is that your nerd voice, by the way?
Yeah,
it is.
That's a good one.
Yeah. That's
right. Man of a thousand voices.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so tired of hearing that because decoction is not mashing is not about, you know, like having well modified malts and making your process as efficient as possible to make your beer, you know, as fermentable as possible, as quickly fermentable as possible, as quick as possible. So, you know, decoction has about I think about seven benefits to it that have nothing, one of which has to do with conversion of enzymes. But you've got this formation of melanoidins. In the case of our double decoction, we're actually creating both free amino nitrogen for yeast health and lower molecular weight proteins for better foam. We're pre-boiling off the precursors of DMS, which is cream corn flavor, aroma, rolling rock, totally.
Yeah.
And we're pre-coagulating our proteins so that we get a nice clear beer without filtering, without having to filter and remove like the beauty of like the yeast character that you get in an unfiltered beer, but you still have something pleasant to look at. And I'm holding up our Vienna right now, which looks like it's a filtered beer, but it's not. It's nice and clear, and it has a deep character.
Clear beer. That's not cool.
It's not cool.
It's not what the kids are into.
Our Vienna does not sell out in a day.
No one's, people are lining up for our beers.
No, not yet. No. But they're having a good time drinking. Yeah.
It also doesn't go bad in a day.
Wow. Yeah. Shots fired.
So anyway, that's my spiel. Okay.
Good. Why don't you talk a little bit about turbid mashing, since we're on the mashing thing, and these are terms that, you know, I think a lot of our listeners probably heard, but maybe aren't that familiar with. And you guys do this for your spontaneous fermentation. Yeah, I don't want to say lambic because
we don't make lambic.
You don't make lambic. Yep. We're not in the lambic region, right?
Yep.
We're in the Chicago.
Yeah, you're making.
Yeah,
we gotta come up with a cooler name than that.
give it 500 years, and then somebody will figure it out.
Someone will figure it out.
The Ravenswood Valley.
Yes. Yes.
Oh yeah.
We're deep in the Ravenswood Valley right now.
without the Metra and the Brown Line, there would be no. Spontaneous fermentation in the Ravenswood Valley.
It's just like the strawberry fields, really. Yeah.
Time to update the beer encyclopedia.
Yeah.
All right, but
so turbid mashing. You know, you end up with a wort that is very cloudy, and that's thus turbid mash.
Why, Hagen?
Hagen, why?
This is what you do. You. It's almost the exact opposite of a decoction mash. It's for any brewers out or home brewers out there. It's a step infusion mash with draw offs at every step. So you draw off the cloudy wort at every temperature step, and you reserve that, and you heat it up. Beyond the point where enzymes are active, so you denature the enzymes in that cloudy wort, and your final wort has starch in it, and the reason that you want that is that in a spontaneously fermented beer you are using certain yeasts, Brettanomyces. Are able to ferment starches as well as sugars. So, and your fermentation process goes on for three years or more, and like Brettanomyces is present in that, and it's trying to stay alive. And when it runs out of sugars, it starts slowly chewing on the starches that are left, and when it digests starches, it's a little bit like when Bill Westlink has a nice portion of steak, and it puts out a bunch of funky flavors.
I had steak last night.
I don't think Bill likes that comparison.
I am not allowed behind the bar sometimes.
But what you're saying is...
Or maybe anymore, I don't know.
It's not... No, the starch... Now I've turned everybody off to our spontaneous...
Ooh, come drink a beer. Yeah.
No, but when it puts out these they're actually pretty wonderful, like funky.
Thank you, Hagen.
I would compare it, you know, to say blue cheese, you know, like blue cheese versus Emmental. You know, like Emmental is like a nice lager, and then blue cheese or Stilton, you know, that awesome like funky cheese that is a lot like, you know, like a lambic, in that it's got all these different flavors, you know, like you know, flavors and aromas like leather or you know, horse blanket or what, you know, whatever, you know, that's that in small portions makes for a really interesting drinking experience. And it's a little bit of a acquired taste, but
so you're saying those those starches that, you know, haven't been, you know, traditionally you're trying to convert all those starches to sugar or something easy for the yeast to eat.
Yep.
By keeping those starches, you're actually prolonging the fermentation process. You're keeping that wild yeast slowly active a longer period of time.
Yep.
With like a different food source.
That's it.
Yep.
That's it. And it takes
kind of
a
harder food source to eat, which therefore takes longer and
takes a long time to for those yeasts to metabolize those starches. But totally worth it when you get the final product.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm not as obviously as I don't have that much experience with wild yeast, but I have made a couple over at Lake Effect with Clint. And, you know, the funnest, most interesting aspect to it all is tasting them. So we tasted it last week, you know, and I mean, it's just amazing how it changes. And it's very sudden sometimes, the change, whereas, you know, it tastes the same for months and then boom, something happened, you know. I'm always trying to bug Clint about, you know, well, what do you think caused this? He's like, I don't know. You just wait, you know.
It's true.
You know, it's like if we all knew, I guess we would, try to replicate it. But it's just something that happens. Sometimes it doesn't, right?
That's true. I mean, we just had a barrel wake up yesterday.
Yeah.
Just 40 feet away from here, and all of a sudden there was like beer all over the floor, and it just, whatever is in that barrel decided, time to get to work. And this is a barrel that we...
How old was the barrel?
It's over in that aisle. It's probably 6 months old.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It seems like such a contrast to the normal brewing process that seems to be relatively, you know, precise. So is that, as a brewer, is that terrifying or fun or maybe a combination of both?
I think it's very fun.
Okay. Yeah.
It's, we don't come up to the barrel loft too much and look at stuff because we don't have a lot of time.
Sure.
But, I don't think we'd be doing all this if we didn't like it and think it was fun.
Yeah.
It's just.
Well, that's why we make the beers we make downstairs. You know, like that beer is like, or like our lager beers are like, it's very German in character. Right? We know what we're putting in. We know what we get out.
That's his German accent. Yeah.
I'm one telling of, you, man of a thousand voices.
One of them.
Yeah, that's a German colonel.
It's specific to the colonel rank. Awesome. Well, let's stay on your spontaneously fermented program and talk a little bit. You guys just released the Creek, which was delicious. You want to talk a little bit about. You know, how long that took and the process and maybe what's coming next?
Yeah, so the Creek, it is delicious. Still available out there, guys. Don't worry.
It is still out there.
So that was, just released that a few months ago. And that beer was...
July 10th was our release date.
There you
go. At the Hop Leaf, yeah.
So in total, it was about a little over 2 years that beer took to make. Started out... We sampled 48 of our barrels from the first year of making beer here in Chicago, spring of 2016. We got five batches of spontaneously fermented beer in barrels. It's grown a little bit since then. And of those 48, we chose 16 that we thought made a nice blend together. And then...
how much? So 16 used barrels. So how much beer is that?
Like that is,
how many kegs of beers?
What are 16 is?
No, you didn't know there was going to be math.
3,200 liters. Kegs, I don't know. That was I think what did we get? We got 25 sixtels, 5 half barrels, and 4,700 and something 500 milliliter bottles.
Okay.
So good amount.
Good amount.
Yeah, decent amount.
I think. Yep. Yeah.
It was I think it was during that spring when we were making this beer is when we met a customer in the tap room that worked across the street at the time, and his job was vegetable and fruit logistics. So he moved fruit and vegetables across the country from farm to warehouse and warehouse to supermarket or wherever.
Yeah, produce broker, basically.
Produce broker, yep. Yeah. And so he's like, hey, you know, if you guys need anything, any fruit or anything, just let me know. I'll find it for you. So he said, Joe.
I know people.
Joe, it turns out we do. We need some cherries. So he found us some cherries. And
we need a very specific cherry.
Very specific cherry, yeah. This is the Balaton cherry.
Balaton cherry.
Balaton, yeah. Originates from Hungary on the shores of Lake Balaton, or Balatan, in a particular town, and I forget the name of that town. But I did meet some people that were both born from that town.
Oh, why did you specifically need those cherries? What was the characteristic that they were giving?
Well, there's two cherries grown in the Midwest here. There's the Balaton
sour. There's two sour cherries.
Sour cherries, yeah. And the Montmorency. Montmorency is used primarily for cough syrups and cherry pies and all that kind of stuff. And the other cherry really doesn't have that. That cough syrup quality. Uh-huh. Has a little bit more of a rich, earthy flavor to it, and so that was more appropriate to the beers we were adding to it.
Yeah, it's more like a Central European Morello cherry. I think it is a Morello cherry, but it's related, very closely related to it. And it has.
How do they taste just on the table?
Fantastic.
Yeah, man, they're good.
Is this tart. like a if I go up to Michigan, are these the types of cherries I might get on the roadside?
Mostly you'll get the Montmorencies.
Okay.
So yeah. It's
about 10% of cherries grown in Upper Great Lakes are Balatons and the rest are Montmorency.
Okay. Awesome.
Yep. So they're really nice and tart, like a nice balance of tart and sweet. And they don't have that cough drop kind of bitterness.
Yeah, a little darker skin than the Montmorency.
Yep, maybe a little smaller even.
Good pit to pith ratio.
Do you have to de-pit them?
We do now. We add pits and pith.
Gotcha.
We do de-stem and de-leaf.
If you want to taste it at home, if you go to the store and find the European brand sour cherry jam, that's that same cherry.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So Joe found us a grower up in Leelanau.
Yeah. Yeah.
That grows the Balatons and got those. He actually rented a van last year and drove up and picked up the cherries for us.
Wow.
And actually did that again this year for next year's batch of Creek. And we got a ton of cherries.
One literal ton.
Literally a ton.
Literal ton.
Yeah. And we had a de-stemming party.
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
volunteers.
Sounds fun to de-stem all of those.
Yeah, one ton last year took us about 8 hours. We had actually some brewers from Mexico in helping us out. Someone met the night before at Hop Leaf, I think.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
It's super fun, yeah, because basically, everybody comes in, and you just end up sitting in circles, just kind of de-stemming the cherries, and everybody just talks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you talk, and like we
drink,
you know,
some beers.
Drink beers and have a little lunch. And yeah, it's a really good time. And I think last year and this year it was, we did it on a Sunday, you know, so.
Yeah, something to be said for mindless labor.
Relaxed.
It was super fun.
Yeah, this year, 2 tons only took us 10 hours.
And we had more, I think we had more volunteers, too.
That's awesome.
It was cool, you know, and like kind of people like met each other, too, and like everybody has like similar interests. You know, if you're drawn to a de-stemming party at a brewery, you probably.
Self-selecting, probably
good chance you'll be friends with some people.
Yeah,
Yeah, so then the we added the creek to these cherries that volunteers destemmed and sat for 11 months just because we kind of forgot about it.
we were just too busy to bottle it.
Yep. And, put it in bottles and drank it. Continue to drink
excellent.
It.
Any plans on any other fruits to be used?
Got a bunch of other fruit going.
Right now we got raspberries. Thanks to Joe Daniel again. He hooks up with a grower in Michigan. So got some framboise.
Nice.
And peaches. Hagen just got some peaches from his aunt and uncle's tree out in Mount Prospect.
Yep. Oh, cool.
It's a Mount Prospect peaches.
Yep. So it's a foraged. It's a foraged one.
My neighbor had a peach tree. And, you know, it was nice. We got peaches every year. He had to cut it down. It was diseased. And now I'm using it to smoke meat at home, and I was always a hickory man.
Nice.
Peach wood, man, it's the way to go.
Those fruit woods are nice.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, it's really nice. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Anyway,
man, that's cool.
I digress.
Pat, you've talked about this before in terms of like how when you go back to choosing. You mentioned how you choose the barrels and you taste the barrels. I imagine that process is interesting, and you're trying to predetermine how the blend's going to taste because each barrel would be different.
Correct.
How does that process work? Like how is it kind of gut? And I assume you can only be so technical in that approach.
Yeah, well, you know, with this style of beer, we're looking for a certain character.
Sure.
And so if we find barrels that have those characters
that character would be good.
yep. Not bad.
This one's good. You guys don't. you guys don't separate them into like maybe different flavor profiles
or
anything.
We've got this barrel is shit. this barrel's all right. This barrel's boring. This barrel's awesome.
I need 4 boring, 2 shits, and 6 goods.
You know, this barrel we're sending to Revlon.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I know when I visited Goose years, and it was a long time ago, back when Lafleur was in charge of the barrel program over there, and it was mostly BCS stuff, but they were, they had like 4 descriptors that they would label the barrels under, you know, like this one's honey, this one's coffee, you know, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But you guys are just
that's kind of what it ends up coming down to.
Yeah.
So there's you know, there's there are different levels of acidity. There are different levels of funk. There are different
levels of fruitiness.
Yep.
Yeah.
Some you know different levels of solvent, which is a nice character in very very small quantities, fruitiness, and then different types of fruitiness. You know, there's sort of a cidery quality, or pineapple, or tropical fruit quality.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of that, and there's some that are just very bland.
Will you do know? Like a small blend, you know, like in a pint glass, and sort of go, yeah, we like these proportions, yeah.
Yeah, that's you know, that's what we did for the framboise. Mm-hmm. You know, we only needed 4 barrels, so we just kind of made a nice blend, and same with like XO2. You know, XO2 was in the barrels. I think that was a total of 16, and we ended up using only 10 or 11 of them. Because the blend just tasted right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the, was that the Rausch one?
No, that was just the second one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had that on tap.
Yeah.
That was very good.
Yeah, X01 was 21 barrels. We chose 19.
Okay.
So. Yeah. But we hung on to the other two to see what would happen this year. So,
Kitten, you can kind of maybe use those or repurpose those at some point. Potentially,
yeah, or yeah, they may get better over time, you know. Yeah. I'm getting better with time.
It's debatable.
No, okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat.
So, my only my opinion counts, guys.
So let's move on to the traditional German, the German beer that you are making.
Is that your best accent?
Yeah, I'm the man of a thousand voices, but they all sound the same. it's bad. So I know, you know, the first time I came in here and saw the open fermenters, it was incredibly reminiscent of the small breweries that I had visited in Bavaria. And, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, when you guys first started, I'm like, oh, have you checked out Dovetail? They're like, yeah, they have these open fermenters. What the fuck
that's
is
crazy.
That? Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. That's going to be terrible. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not an expert, but people do it all over Germany. Yeah. It doesn't seem to be a problem.
Well, yeah, well, so there's like 9,000 years of documented, you know, fermentation, and like 100 of them are closed fermentation.
Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. You know. Is that the cool ships, right? Is that what they're?
No,
I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
Those are the fermenters that we have in primary fermentation. So our first fermentation takes place in these round open vessels.
Okay.
And the you know, so the reason we do that, I mean, well, if the reason that we got interested in it was. You know, like same as you. Like we went to breweries over in Europe, and we saw people doing open fermentation. The first thing you think is, yeah, that's crazy. And then you taste the beer, and you're like, holy crap!
Yeah,
this is incredible.
Well, they say the yeast is just happier having sort of an open environment. And,
yep.
And you guys are primarily, you know, how many yeast strains are you guys using down there? One or two? Two.
We have
right now is four.
Four.
Three. Well, we got that Saison strain, too.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
It's hidden down there, yeah. Uh-oh. Yes, there is, yeah.
Are you worried about cross-contamination?
It's a concern, but cross-contamination is more of a procedural concern because you don't have to worry about yeast, like, going into the air.
Jumping.
And into the next fermenter. You know, we do a lot of skimming. With a spoon, so we do top cropping on our ales, and we reserve the next batch or the yeast for repitching in the next batch, and we do skimming on the lagers. So we skim off like the first stuff that rises. You call it the dirt skim, and it's like it's got a lot of proteins mixed in it. And if you get those proteins out, it's a better tasting, like kind of a finer tasting beer. So the danger is that you move your spoon from an ale to a lager without cleaning and sanitizing that spoon first.
Okay.
That's how you cross contaminate.
Gotcha.
Two different yeast strains, because you know, and the real danger is a lager going to an ale rather than an ale to a lager, because lager likes to ferment at low temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But it loves to ferment at high temperature.
Right.
And the same is not true for ales. Ales won't ferment well at low temperature.
Won't do much.
Right, yeah. Right.
So that's where the cross-contamination concern comes from. And basically, you know, like it's all a matter of like training and procedures. Like we skim or crop one tank at a time and then clean and sanitize the spoon.
So you're saying that first cleaning of the Kreuzen, will affect the beer flavor.
Absolutely.
In a positive way.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something that simply isn't done by anyone, by everyone else.
Right. You
right?
Can't,
you can't do that.
You can't do that.
With a closed fermenter, which is what everyone else uses.
Yep.
So that's interesting. Huh. I haven't heard that. Okay.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
Yeah,
you know, like they, I don't know. In Germany, they call, you know, they that I've heard brewers you know, like taste, or I've seen brewers taste a beer, and they'll be like, yeah, it's a farmer beer. You know, because it doesn't have like a refined flavor to it, and that's just from, you know, not taking care of it as well as you could.
Is that some sort of farmer slur?
It is. It's a German anti-farmer slur.
Farmer beer.
Farmer beer.
I'm gonna use that term.
Bauernbier. That's what they say.
I like it.
But yeah, I mean, so like basically we have a philosophy about yeast. You know, so we always say the yeast are like people. They like sugar. They like to reproduce, and they don't like stress. And that's what open fermentation is all about. Because the main stressor on yeast is pressure. And in the case of our Hefeweizen, is a very stress intolerant strain. So it's like the diva of all yeast. And a little bit of pressure, a little bit of stress, it stops putting out the nice clove and banana that you really want in a Hefeweizen. And you just want to amplify all that flavor in a Hefeweizen.
And that is, you know, that's kind of the one exception of brewer's perception here. In America, they always go, oh, well, if you're going to do open fermentation, that's just for Hefeweizens. And, you know, that's not the case, right?
I feel like we're so absolutist here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, well, we just get told something and then we believe it.
Yeah. And it helps Hefeweizen, but it also helps any kind of yeast.
Yeah. When I was at Sierra Nevada doing the beer camp, you know, we came up with this. Well, I bullied everyone in doing a lager, of course. But, you know, there were other people involved, so it had to be a hoppy lager. We had to dry hop it. But they have, you know, they make this wonderful Hefeweizen called Kellerweiz.
Yeah.
And I love it. I mean, I think it's one of the best in the country. And they...
Great beer.
Yes. And they install open fermenters just to make that beer. It's the only beer they make in there. And they even had open fermenters on their pilot system that we used.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, you know, can we open ferment this lager? And the brewer was like, you know, we only use that for Kellerweiss. And, you know, I guess we could, you know. Like, it was kind of a revelation for him, too. And he was like, you know, let me ask the upper-ups. So he had to go ask somebody. Is it okay to make the lager? I remember he came back about an hour later, and we were doing a tour, and he's like, we're good to go. We're going to make it in the open fermenter. So I'm proud to say I spurred Sierra Nevada to use their open fermenter for a lager for the first time.
Man. Oh, man, I bet Sierra Nevada pale ale would be, I mean, it's an awesome beer anyway, but
right.
like open fermented would probably be just like a notch better.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. They should find out.
Yeah. They should find out. Yeah. They should draw off some wort into their
into their pilot system.
Yeah. Nothing to say they haven't. Who knows? Who knows? But they hadn't at that point.
Yeah. Man, that sounds like fun.
It was really incredible, actually. That's like the Willy Wonka factory of beer. This is the one in Asheville.
Wow.
It was amazing, you know. Everything that you would have possibly want in a brewery was there.
Man, I bet.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, we heard about those open fermenters they had for Kellerweiss. So that the manufacturer, our open fermenters are 20 years old. They're used.
Mm-hmm.
We found them in Germany, or somebody found them for us. But it's the same manufacturer that manufactures the ones for Sierra.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you they are worried about, well, I mean, it must be cross. I don't know, but the one open fermenter they make, the Kellerweiss, and the big one, the 300 barrels or whatever it is, the top of it is in a room that you're not allowed to go in.
Really?
Yeah. And it had like... you know, it's all sealed off. You can look at it from the upstairs bar, but they wouldn't let us go in there. And you know, apparently it's
like
it's
a vacuum
limit.
Sealed room or something. Yeah.
It seemed like it. I don't know if it was, but yeah, it seemed like there were some rules to going in there.
So our primary fermentation area is under positive pressure.
Okay.
So we have net flow of air out of the room. So so when you open the door to it, you'll feel a rush of air.
Oh, okay.
And then, but we're also pulling out CO2 from the bottom, from the floor.
Is that to keep
in there
anything from coming in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So
plus CO2 is kind of dangerous.
Sure. CO2 is dangerous, right?
Sure.
But yeah, it
can kill.
It's also like just a small flow of air will keep, you know, like fruit flies out.
Oh, okay.
But if there's too much traffic back and forth, you could lose that net positive,
right.
or if you prop the door open, you'd lose the positive pressure too. So yeah, it's important to be careful about it. But you know, like the way we look at it, and is that you know, humans have had this 9,000 year relationship with brewing yeast. And the reason that we have that relationship is that yeast takes care of itself. It protects its own source of food. Number one, through the production of croizin, so the foamy cap on top of a vigorously fermenting beer, and then number two, the production of CO2. So CO2 is heavier than air. And any fermenting beer is going to have a nice cap of CO2 laying on top of it, and and when it's vigorously fermenting, it's going to be pouring out over the sides of an open fermenter, which is going to create another, you know, like breeze that keeps anything out. Plus, you know, self-preservation on the part of the fruit fly is going to keep it from flying into a blanket of CO2.
Right, right, right.
And that's just. It's just something that we luckily happened into, you know, 9,000 years ago, some of our ancestors.
Yeah. For like 8,800 years, we didn't even know yeast existed.
Yeah, exactly.
Magic.
Exactly.
God's will, right?
Yep. That's right. Yep. The stuff.
Proof God loved us.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I was reading a study. It was basically saying that because of this history, that kind of like dogs or other domesticated animals, humans have basically, and yeast, that relationship has led to this, you know, it's happened over a long time, and now we have this. It's really interesting when you think about it.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
That's cool.
And I think that's one of the things we try to do is like, try not, like we know, you know, so we studied brewing. We know all the theory behind it, but then, you know, like try not to overcomplicate it too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still stuff that, you know, you just, time is the only answer to the,
totally.
To the question, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pills and the pilsner that we make, the Bohemian Pilsner.
Two different beers.
Two different beers.
Okay. You might want to come up with like maybe a little more clever name. I know you guys are pressed for time, but
like, no, this one's pills, this one's Pilsner.
Like, you know, I'm pretty sure pills is short for Pilsner, Bill.
So yes, so the idea, Pat, is that Pilsner is a beer from the town of Pilsen,
yes,
and Pils is a style that came from that town that is brewed in a town that is not Pilsen.
Well, this isn't Pilsen, so
that's why it's a Pils.
But then you have a Pilsner too,
Bohemian style Pilsner.
Oh my God! But all I'm saying is. Maybe branch out on the names, okay?
Bill's Pills?
Maybe.
Bill's Pills. Well, yeah, yeah. I'm not a marketing expert, but yeah. I
would. Those are in his desk. Bill's Pills.
That is not short for Bill's Pills.
Something's got to keep me happy.
That's right. That's right.
No, but so that's an 8-week beer, and it doesn't. I mean, we could probably release it at 4 weeks, but we wouldn't be happy with it because
that's good sex.
Because we feel like, you know, highly hopped 35 IBU beer.
Stop.
35 IBU.
Stop.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
It just needs that time.
Remember those days
for all of the flavors to kind of balance out, and all the aspects of the beer to be just right.
Yeah,
because you get that. So the Pilsner, we do a a triple decoction, and we got that nice maltiness. But then that the hops settle down. Like, there's a certain harshness that leaves right there between like week 7 and 8, and it's good to go. And like in the terms of like real, I think Czech Pilsner, we're absolute sellouts, because like the real Czech Pilsners are done for like 12 weeks. And I think it makes
a difference.
I think it really does. It does reach a peak at like 12 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Do you guys think that we've finally, you know, obviously you take your lagers very serious. And
really?
I think, yeah.
You think so?
Seems that way anyway. But, you know, the craft beer world, especially in the United States, is not necessarily taking lager serious.
Yep.
You know, despite the fact that it's incredibly hard style to brew and takes longer and all the rest of it, do you feel that a corner has been turned? Because, I mean, lagers seem to be finally be getting, you know, entrance into the cool kid club here in the craft beer world. What do you think?
I think so. Seems like there's a bunch of like-minded people that we've met that are and heard about that are doing similar things. Also, like Bierstadt in Denver, KC Beer in Kansas City.
We've always had Metropolitan here in Chicago.
Of course.
You know?
Of course, yeah.
Yep. I always like to make fun of Doug, you know, because, you know, like, hey, look at all the attention Dovetail's getting. The new lager brewery in town. You guys have been doing it for 7 years. No one's mentioning it, but, you know, he seems to hate me every time I say that, so I think it's working.
talk about a ballsy move. When they opened,
yeah,
to do what they were doing,
yeah, and they just stuck with it, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, things didn't always go great for them, and you know, they did not get a lot of attention. Certainly not, you know, the attention you guys got when you opened. And yeah, I think it was very ballsy, and speaks volumes as to Doug and Tracy sticking to their guns, which is what
totally.
They do. Yeah,
totally.
When it comes, so you guys are now over 2 years old, correct? Is that right? Yeah. So relatively young brewery. Have there been, maybe if you could rattle off some of the biggest challenges and successes you've had to date so far, if you don't mind. Sorry, that's a hard question.
Staying open.
Maybe.
Yeah, every day is a challenge for these two.
Yeah.
You know, I think a big challenge is our pills and Pilsner conundrum.
that's been my biggest
beer
challenge
education
today.
I mean, on the production side, it is a challenge to take the time that we've taken. We tried to you know, defeat that challenge by having enough fermenters. So we've got a lot of lager tanks downstairs. We've got more tanks or more fermentation than most breweries that would of our size would start with.
Sure.
And we compromised by using used dairy equipment and adapting it to our brewing methods, because we, you know, when you lay it out on paper, you know, you have to have a certain amount of fermentation available to make these beers in the way that we think is the right way. So,
by the way, your fermenters are the traditional elongated.
Yep.
Why is that the preferred fermentation vessel for lager? For those listening, what I'm talking about is, I think everyone's familiar with the stand-up conical fermenters.
Yep. CCVs. Right.
Right.
Cylindrical with the they've got the cone on the bottom, and then they're
unitanks.
Then they're tall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yours are basically laid on their side.
Yep.
With no cone. Why is that the preferred vessel for lagering?
We didn't have the height.
No, but we would have done
That's
it.
That's true. You don't have to have the height for those. Why doesn't everyone use them?
You don't. So like we said, we do open fermentation, but there's another step involved, because you can't hold a beer in an open fermenter until it's done. So you have to transfer out of that open fermenter while the beer is still fermenting. So you transfer into another tank, and you could transfer into a vertical tank if you wanted to. But we choose to transfer into a horizontal lagering tank because we feel that it has advantages. Like even if we had 25, 30 foot ceilings, we would still do this fermentation in a horizontal lagering tank because of the same reason that we mentioned earlier, yeast stress. So you have less stress on the yeast as it's finishing that fermentation, as it like improves, works to improve the flavors of the beer. And then there's an activity that goes on in maturation that's called flocculation. And everything falls out of suspension to the bottom of the tank and clarifies the beer. It's a lot easier to do that if you have a short distance to fall.
So the
shorter the distance to fall, the better it'll happen, and the more clear your beer will be in its final state. So that's another reason for it.
Interesting.
Yeah, we don't have bright tanks either. Our beer gets carbonated in those tanks.
In the lagering tank?
In the lagering tank, yeah.
Gotcha.
So we let the final fermentation happen in a closed environment, so it actually carbonates up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you're yeast harvesting, you're doing that in the open fermenter anyway, you don't have to worry about... I mean, I know a lot of the reason for the conical is to harvest yeast off the bottom and stuff like that. And
yep.
You guys don't have to worry about that.
Right. Yeah. So that's another advantage of the open.
Yeah.
We get yeast in a really strong, healthy condition. In those open fermenters. Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
But I'll say back to your point about our success and failures. I just think our greatest success is that people like our beer and we keep making it.
Hey, all right.
Yeah. That's harder done than said. That is the hardest part, really.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, and I don't mean to blow smoke, but if I had to come up with a top five brewery list in Chicago, I mean, you guys would definitely be on it. I mean, you guys do awesome stuff. So, I mean, I just think... And when kind of
appreciate
going,
that,
yeah. Well, and I appreciate the beer. I mean, it's really good. I didn't understand. I think because Pat has talked about lagers since I met him, and
really,
and I don't think I maybe understood it, quite as much until having some of your beer and understanding the nuance and depth that you can have in a relatively, in a lighter style of beer. So. Awesome job.
Yeah, I always say that, like, this craft beer movement has matured, and literally, we're all getting old, and we're figuring out that, like, turns out we actually have to drink this shit, and I don't know
every
about
day.
You guys, but yeah, I was just up in Madison for the Great Taste, and I spent the whole day looking for lagers and extra pale ales, and it was 95 fucking degrees, and I'm outside and I'm old, and I saw these lines for like barrel aged stouts and stuff.
Oh,
and I was like,
God.
What? I mean, there you couldn't what on earth about this day makes you want to put that in your mouth? But I think we're at a point in our lives, we're more mature, and we realize that we want to drink a lot of beer, and you just can't do it with a pastry stout or barrel aged anything, or all the rest of it. And I always go back to lager.
Yeah, so do we.
You know what they say: winemakers drink beer, and beer drinkers drink lager. Something like that. Maybe I'm the only one that says that. I might have just made it up.
Brewers drink bourbon.
That's true. Liquor's quicker.
And Bill's pills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have taken up enough of your brew day. Literally, you guys are in the middle of a brew. So,
Dunkel's coming.
Oh, can't wait. Let's do their shameless plugs.
Yeah.
You can each do a shameless plug. Sweet. Bill, let's start with you.
Bill's Pills, you know? It's great stuff.
Do you crush it and snort it, or is this the one you
drink? You know, it's,
he's got this spoon with these really weird
brands. Yeah, you know. do I open the left drawer, the right drawer, center drawer? It's all, you know, different means to the end. But it all works.
Oh, you, my gosh.
You guys have an Oktoberfest coming up.
Oh, we yeah. Hey.
We are not great marketers.
That's why other people do it for us. All I'm thinking of is drugs. But yeah, Oktoberfest anniversary. That's a good plug. October 6th and 7th, 1800 West Belle Plaine Avenue. Find our delicious beers along with Beguiles. And a little bit of food, a little bit of bands, a little bit of, a lot of beer. It'll be a good time. Hopefully it's not going to be 96